Welcome to Political Rewind. I'm Donna Lowry with GPB Lawmakers, and I'm filling in today for Bill Nygaard. Thanks for joining us. A reminder that you can log on to GPB News, our Facebook page. We hope you're watching right now. You can not only hear us there, but you can also see us, and we'll monitor your comments there. You can also comment on our Facebook page, our Twitter page, I should say, at PoliticsGPB. So let's meet our guests. I'm really excited about the show today. James Salser, thanks for being here. You and I have worked together for a long time, long-time state government and politics reporter for the AJC.
Thanks for having me.
And you know the budget better than anybody, so we're gonna really dive in with you. Senator Harold Jones II is here from Augusta. You are from Augusta, but you're a member of the Rules Committee.
Yes.
Judiciary and Public Safety.
That's great. So and economic development.
And economic development. Yes. We're going to get into that a little bit more.
Okay.
Next to you is Taifa Smith Butler. Thanks. It's first time meeting you. Glad you're here. President and CEO of the Georgia Budget and Policy Institute. And your group has a mission that focuses on economic opportunity.
Yes.
And you're a think tank that focuses a lot on trying to get people into jobs, too, right? A little bit of that.
Part of the story.
And then. And then somebody I've worked with for a long time, especially with education, Representative Dave Belton of Buckhead, Georgia.
The real Buckhead, Georgia.
The real Buckhead, member of House Appropriations Committee, so we're glad you're here, but also with education and a few other committees. So you and I have worked together a lot with education. So thanks, all of you, for being here. Let's get right to it. The House passed the mid-year budget yesterday that restores some of Governor Kemp's proposed cuts. Came back with all of that. And James, I know you've been following this all along and from the beginning. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, first of all, I'm glad we're like a fourth of the way there.
Because
the Senate's got to pass it, and then they have to pick up the 2021 budget. So the House and the Senate at the same time have held hearings for most of the last month and heard from agency directors and people who will be affected by the cuts. And, they expressed a lot of concern about a lot of different areas. It would like take all day to go through, you know, the areas. But
it did take a while, too.
Line by line. The big kind of takeaways were restoring some of the money that would be cut from like mental health, substance abuse programs, a number of vacant positions that they deemed to be, the House deemed to be important enough to not just give up the job. A food safety inspector was one I know just caught people's eyes like, what? We're going to have, you know, fewer food, you know, inspections at grocery stores and, you know, 7-Elevens and whatnot. And GBI Crime Lab was another area that we've had a long-standing problem of having backlogs on rape kits, and we have, you know, more DNA testing than we know what to do with. Excuse me. So the idea of cutting scientists and lab techs, you know, just seemed counterintuitive. So there's a whole long
behavioral
list
health. That was a big issue. A lot of things with that. Representative Belton, you're in House Appropriations. Give us an idea of what the last week or so has been like for you guys.
Well, it's been really tough. We've had to go through hundreds of hours, really, of looking line by line, trying to find some savings. We did a lot of that in the Public Safety Appropriations Committee, which I'm on, trying to minimize the impact of the fact that most Georgians and try to be most efficient with our resources we possibly can, and also try to, you know, leverage our resources, especially in the ag extensions. You talked about that, James, a little bit, and accountability courts. We get a lot of accountability courts specifically. We feel like we get $7 out of every dollar we spend, and the same thing with the ag extension, which actually goes into the science of agriculture. I don't know if you knew this, Donna, but we have the farmers today feeds 155 people, and back in 1950s, only fed 14 people. So the farmers today are doing a lot of great work because of the science of farming. It's actually quite it's a hard thing to do, and they're doing a great job. And if they weren't doing that great job, we couldn't be feeding the world like we are.
Yeah, I'm glad that we're going to show. I have a little sound in a minute with the Appropriations Chair England in a minute, but I want to get to you, Taifa, a little bit, and your thoughts on the cuts that were restored that the governor had wanted.
Yeah, I think it was fascinating to see sort of this competing priorities conversation, especially in the last couple of years where we've made slow investments since the recession to improve behavioral health and children's mental health and making those investments. So to see the House sort of hold the line, and I heard Chairman England say some of these cuts are regressive. They take us back. And so we appreciated the sort of lessening of the cuts for behavioral health, for public health, which, you know, we all know that the county infrastructure is sometimes the only game in town to provide health care for Georgians. So we were pleased to see that. But I really want to make sure we understand the broader context of how we got here. And everyone that we've talked to, and one of my teammates texted me this morning, everyone in the community is like, how did this happen, right? And so I just want us to be clear, because I think the narrative James and I was talking about this morning about sort of the Hurricane Michael and its impact in 2018. But, you know, early 2018, we passed a legislation to cut the income tax, which is 51% of our budget, right? And so that cut, in addition to increased spending to improve teacher salaries, that pressure has created the situation we're in. Cutting the income tax, upward pressure on some of the investments that we want to make in terms of paying people, and also Hurricane Michael. I think those three things have created sort of the scenario of the cuts.
Yeah, and we have a sound from Chairman England on Hurricane Michael in particular. And let's run that right now, and then we can talk to you, Senator Jones.
I feel that it is important as we continue to pull out of the trough of Hurricane Michael, depressed commodity prices, and what we've seen with some of the trade wars going on, that it's important to continue to support our number one industry in this state, and that being agriculture.
All right. So, Senator Jones, I want to get your comments on what you've heard. So we're hearing more of a push toward that and less of the state income tax cut from a few years ago.
Well, those are things that obviously can happen when you have a hurricane or something of that nature. But the key thing is, was the income tax cut, which on the Democratic side actually voted against. And I was one of those that did that, because when you start placing holes in the budget of that way, we have to understand that we actually have to pay for services. We always talk about being number one state for business, and that is a good thing. But business also relies on paying for services. It relies on education. It relies on good roads. It relies on good infrastructure. So those are things that we also have to be adamant about also paying for. So one of the kind of concerning things about yesterday was not only saying that the main concern may be Hurricane Michael, but also some of the talk about continuing now to cut taxes again. That also was very concerning.
And let's talk about that, because James has a front page story on the AJC today about that. And you're hearing that from the speaker and from Chairman England, that they want to push through this promised cut.
Right. And they aren't the only ones, but they're the face of those cuts. The other element of the original tax cut that I think we forget is Governor Deal in 2018 said, let's not do this right now, because we don't know what the impact will be. We don't know if we're going to get it, you know, the size of windfall from the federal income tax cut or not. So that also, I've also heard economists say we didn't get the benefit of that, at the federal tax.
That's right.
So that kind of added to the $500 million or so that you were going to lose, that they knew that the legislature knew they were going to lose, or those who voted for it from the first income tax cut. So.
Which was 5.75% in 2018.
It was 6 to 5.75, and this would get, the next one would go 5.75 to 5.5, and it kind of depends how they structure it. But it was just an interesting juxtaposition that you just got done a month long hand wringing of the various things that the governor wanted to cut in the budget. You passed a budget in which you mitigated clearly some of the things that you thought were the worst or the most devastating cuts. And then immediately you go to, oh, and by the way, we're going to cut taxes, which no matter how you do it, it's going to be less revenue again.
Taifa, I know you want to jump in here.
Yeah, I mean, the math does not work at the end of the day. With the first cut, we lost $550 million to the base, in addition to increasing teacher salaries and improving state employees' salaries. So that base is new, and that base has to be sustained. And then to come back now and then suggest or consider an additional cut, which are, based on our calculations, could be upwards of $615 million eroding of the base. Where, you know, if, you know, I think in Georgia, we have to decide the state that we want to be. We, right now, in 2019, we're 50th when it came to spending per person since the recession. So our budget has not grown. We are 48th in the country when it comes to state spending and taxes, I mean, and per person. So we are a low tax state. We are not investing, and we talk about wanting to improve rural infrastructure and all these things, but we're not willing to pay for it. And to consider another tax cut at this moment in time when the first income tax has already shown us that we have created a slowing in our economy, to do it again, I think, would be a failure.
Representative Belton, I know you were part of all of this last week, and your feelings about this.
Sure. Well, obviously, we cannot do the teacher pay raise and the income tax and the taxes cuts. We can't do all three of those. So we're going to have to do some kind of compromise. But when you say that you're 50th in the nation in spending per person, that's a good thing. It means we're a lean government. We're not. I'd rather have the money in the taxpayer's pocket than in the government's pocket. So I like talking about that.
All right. Senator Jones?
Yeah, well, if you look at it, we start talking about persons making between maybe $40,000, $80,000. That money in a person's pocket may be about $400 or $500. But now if you make over about $250,000, that money in a person's pocket is about $5,000. So there's a difference there. But also, you know, when you start talking about we've had like the largest budget or things of that nature, that's because we're a growing state. But also when you're a growing state, you have a lot of persons who are coming here who also have needs and need services. It's not necessarily a badge of honor to say that you're at 50 on spending, but at the same time, you're in the middle of education. At the same time, your poverty level is higher than maybe the national average. So those things, you want to balance that out. You don't want to just say we're 50 in spending, but at the same time, we have a higher poverty level. Or at the same time, you know, a lot of our education is still kind of flat. That's not a good thing. So we need to try to balance that out. Be lean on spending, that's fine, but at the same time, let's make sure we provide services to our people.
That's the thing that I think people, I think this was shocking to people when you say I'm going to cut the, you know, X programs, is that we have traditionally had very conservative legislators running the appropriations committees, and I mean Chairman Englund in the House and Chairman Hill in the Senate are not walking around throwing, you know, $100 bills at people. I mean, they study the economy, and they study tax revenue month by month, you know, all year long. And so it's probably shocked to the system a little bit that you passed a budget in, would have been March or April of last year, and the governor 3 or 4 months later says, oh, by the way, what you just did, we got to take $500 million out of it. And if you know the players involved, you're just like, well, you know, if they had $500 million, those people probably would have taken it out, you know, during the session.
But I want to say, you know, the budget is growing. It's not like the budget's going down. It's just not growing as much as we thought it was. We expected to spend $27.5 billion. And now we're going to spend 27.38, but that's still a 1.7%, $450 million increase. So it's the difference between $450 million increase to $609 million increase. So the budget is growing, and next year it's going to go to 28.1.
Right, but a big percentage of that is enrollment growth in schools
that's
and
right.
Medicaid. I mean,
which
huge
is a great story.
Yeah.
It's wonderful that we're finally funding QBE, and our education scores are the best they've ever been, ever in Georgia. The graduation rate's best it's ever been. The AP scores the best it's ever been. The NAEP, the nation scorecard for K-12. Our African American AP, we're third in the nation. That's amazing. We're doing great stuff in education.
And then yesterday we heard also that we are doing okay as an economy overall in Georgia. And so this is where I want to get Minority Leader Bob Trammell's bite in. I want to have his sound in. I'm using TV terms. His sound in, where he was on the floor yesterday and he voted against it, and it was 126-46. But let's hear what he had to say about these cuts.
The $159 million that we're about to cut in this supplemental budget aren't just dollars and cents. They have names. And they live in each and every one of our districts. And if we haven't heard from those constituents yet, you can bet in the next year we'll hear from them. And the question will be, why did we have to cut when times were so good?
Taifa, I wanted you to talk about this. He also talked about the rainy day fund and said, some say it's not raining. He said the roof is leaking. They actually leaking.
Right. We had this question yesterday from another reporter about, you know, whether we would take a position on using the rainy day fund. And you think about the amount of cuts that the House is mitigating, the $210 million that the governor suggested, the House change it to $159. And, you know, with a nearly $3 billion reserve, you know, you would think that we could use that. But I believe one-time usage might be fine, but long-term, the question is, or the answer is, we need new revenue. I mean, I think, you know, when we talk about a potential tax cut that's pending, or even the one that was just passed, that we need to be honest about who's going to bear the brunt of that tax cut. Most of the benefit of that tax cut that's being considered right now, 76% of the folks are making over $100,000 a year. So middle class, low income families will not benefit from that tax cut. So let's be honest about, you know, where the people who are paying taxes, again, at the higher income level, will be the ones who benefit from that tax cut for the most part. But what we're seeing, especially in the compelling testimony, is families who depend on the services from mental health, from education. Those are the families that are saying, we need these services. We need the government to continue to invest to make sure that our quality of life is good in our state. And so I think that's the decision we have to make. Pass a tax cut that would largely benefit those at the top of the income ladder versus making sure we have good, strong infrastructure and services that, by and large, most Georgians would benefit from.
And Senator Jones, right. The Senate looks at this next. So what are you expecting?
That's exactly right. As far as the midterm budget that came out, we'll engross that, so it'll be very few changes. It won't be any changes at all, quite frankly. I think you'll probably see a lot of Democrats taking the stance that Leader Trammell also took. I know that I probably will. You know, when we start talking about services, there's nothing wrong with services. I tell people all the time, you should ask your government for services. Everyone that's in that gold dome today is asking for government services. Every single person is asking, how can the government help them advance? Whether it's business or any other type of structure, that's what they're doing. Our regular citizens, our average citizens, should not have any hesitation to also say, we want mental health services. We want to make sure accountability courts are funded. We want to make sure that our police are basically able to be funded because they don't have to take cuts and things of that nature. That's exactly what they ought to be saying. And so when we start talking about services for our average citizens, no one should take a back seat to that, because every single person that has all those people running around up there, they're asking for services.
Yeah. So we have the mid-year budget, which ends at the end of June. And then we've got the same cuts, that 4% at least, will stay there. Then another 2% on top of that. So what are we thinking in terms of whether or not we'll see that take place? What do you think, James?
Well, it's going to take place because the governor hasn't raised the revenue estimate. So,
right.
Will take place. The big question, obviously, is are we going to, who's going to get the pay raise?
Right.
Somebody's going to get a pay raise. I don't think there's any doubt that somebody in there is going to get a pay raise. But the question is, who's going to get the pay raise? How much is it going to be? And, I think in the 2021 budget, that's the kind of the big issue, because a lot of the cuts that were in the governor's proposal just carry over into the next year, and a lot of them are vacant positions. So the House decided, these are important vacant positions that we need to fill. They're going to not, you know, suddenly decide next year you don't have to have them. And the other thing I think is that the House, in several of the subcommittees, there was discussion that, you know, one of the reasons these positions are vacant is because their pay is lousy.
It's terrible, right?
You know, if you have, if you have juvenile justice, but if you have juvenile justice guards making $27,000 a year and they have 100% turnover, which means they have to train people every, you know, every time somebody leaves, you know, that's tough. That's tough to run an agency like that.
Yeah. When, I'm sorry, Donna, when, Commissioner Taylor, Mark Butler, rather, the labor commissioner, talked about most of our state employees are at the 40th percentile. So we are have many of our state employees have borne the brunt up through the recession, even from furloughs, from salary freezes. And we were in Athens last fall talking to folks, the mayor and other leaders, and to see so many state employees in Athens eligible for benefits themselves is just unacceptable, right? So I think, you know, if we are going to invest in our state employees, you know, whether it be teachers or whether it be those others on the front lines, we need new revenue to be able to support that.
Yeah, and that we're focusing a lot on the teachers, but I'm glad you guys are talking about the others. And we know that it's popular for the teacher raises because the UGA study that showed that 88% of the respondents were in favor of the teacher raises over a tax cut. Representative Belton.
So I agree with it. We have to do the teacher pay raise. We got to get that done. Certainly, there, you know, it's possible to be a compromise between the two those things. But I do want to talk about the fact that we have put the money back into the health care. We have put money back in the libraries, public defenders, accountability courts, the GBI and investigations for the rape kits and all the other evidence out there, and especially for ag extensions and the research.
So I think at the 6% level for the 2021 budget, I believe that was about $300 million cuts. If the lawmakers are going to propose this additional rate cut, that's an additional $600. So that cut has to happen now if they're proposing that now or later. So there will be even deeper cuts if we don't come up with alternatives.
And the deeper the cut, the harder it is. You know, the low-hanging fruit is gone. So that's for sure.
I have to say, though, the I read a story I think it was maybe the first week or second week of the session where I said, you know, and there were people that are not happy with it because I said, you know, you could do the rate cut. You could just say it doesn't go into effect until, you know, 2021 or 2022. And then you do, and then you're kicking the can down the road of what you're actually going to do.
Yeah, Winston Churchill says a politician is a guy who has to predict the future, and then when the future doesn't occur, you have to explain why the future didn't occur, but the way he was actually right about the whole time. So it's tough. I mean, you're predicting the economy is like predicting the weather; it doesn't always work out exactly the way you want it to. That Hurricane Michael, it was a $25 billion hurricane. It was a Cat 5, the worst hurricane that ever hit the Panhandle. So that was $2 billion worth of crops that were destroyed. That's a lot of money.
Yeah, but thinking about that in the, you know, we could always have something like that happen again, given and thinking about a tax cut, too.
Well, let me tell you, we have a $2.8 billion rainy day fund. That's amazing. We were down to like a couple hundred million.
About 100 million.
So, you know. Yeah, Leader Trammell brought that up. So
okay, very good.
Okay, so no, we heard him talk about that. So yeah, we know that late rainy day fund there. He said the roof
is leaking.
But the economy
is great. Right. You know, the economy is doing well. The unemployment's record lows. So what they're talking about is not a cut. It's just we're not growing as fast as we thought we would.
Right. And the number sounds great of the rainy day fund, but if you remember the Great Recession, that was gone. I think we had like 1.5 or 1.7, which probably is, I guess, equivalent of 2 today. And that was gone like that. I mean, you had to cut 18%, I believe. And so I think that's probably in the back of the mind of House and Senate leaders is that you really can't. I mean, you can, but it's probably not prudent to touch that because
we're not in a recession.
If we get in a recession, boy, that goes fast. Okay. And that's a month's worth of running state government, essentially.
I also want to just make a note, too, about we keep talking about how good the economy is and unemployment is low. But when we look at middle income and low income families, wages are stagnant or going backwards. And most of the growth is happening to those who are making more. So, again, let's think about how tax cuts might impact those who are already stretched in terms of their own incomes. And if we do want to go home in 2018, and we know this is an election year and we get special in an election year. Let's think about a tax cut for those at the bottom, which a state EITC will be one of those options if lawmakers want to give a tax break to somebody.
Well, I know this is a great discussion. We could talk about the budget the entire hour, but when we want to get to some other things. Yeah. So let's take a quick break right now. And when we return, I want to talk about some non-budget issues, including a bill that could involve guns, but doesn't actually mention guns in the legislation. So you're listening to Political Rewind on GPB. We're back in 1 minute. Welcome back to Political Rewind. I'm Donna Lowry with GPB Lawmakers, and I'm filling in for Bill Nigut today. We have three. I have three guests now. Taifa Smith-Butler had to go, but we have wonderful guests who can talk a lot about the issues we're going to get into. James Sulzer with the AJC, Senator Harold Jones, and Representative Dave Belton. Thanks for sticking around.
Oh, thank you.
thank you for that. So what some may consider one of the most consequential pieces of gun legislation right now before the legislature is this one that doesn't even include the word firearms. Any mention of it? HB 784, for those who care about those kind of numbers, it would allow school boards to actually talk about their school safety plans, which is good, but to do it in private so that nobody else hears what's going on. And that's in that sense, it's good in that you don't want the public to know every single detail of your school safety plan. But the fact that it's in public and private means that people may not, that there's a possibility that the school boards could decide that teachers could carry guns, could have guns in the classrooms.
And I think the vote is also not in the open.
Right. The vote would not be in the open, and we wouldn't know any of the specifics, including the fact that they may not be able to actually, that they may have guns in the schools, and we wouldn't know about that. So I wanted to get your thoughts on that.
Yeah, I would think parents would not, at least some parents would not like that idea. Would want to know.
Well, I know Jim Galloway with the AJC was in touch with somebody who was a parent who lost a child at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas school. And she's on the school board and said, I want transparency, but I also get it. So it's really a tough one, don't you think?
Yeah. It sure is. I mean, we always talk about local control. You know, a couple of years ago, we gave local school boards the ability to arm certain people in the schools if they wanted to. I talked to the author, Chairman Eddie Lumsford, great guy. He's actually law enforcement, and his intention was, you know, if we talk about school safety programs, when you talk about security, you don't want to do that in the open because then the bad guys know exactly what you've planned. So the intention of this bill was to make sure the bad guys don't find out what your security plans were. So I know he's taking a hard look at this right now.
Well, he's spent three decades, I gather, as with the State Patrol, so
That's right.
Knows this. Representative Lumsden, what are your...
It certainly is a balance in that that has to take place. At the same time, you don't want necessarily the whole plan to be out. But it is a legitimate question to say, well, who in the classroom actually has a weapon in the class? And I can understand parents want to know that, too. Yeah.
So we'll have to see where that one goes. Let's talk about something else. A narrowly divided Georgia House committee on Tuesday passed House Bill 888. And I'll give these numbers for people who care about them, because there are people who are really into the numbers.
Oh, yeah.
It aims to reduce, and this is an issue that's even big in my household, surprise medical bills for people with individual insurance plans. And it would stop all types of unexpected large medical bills that are out there that the... But letting people know, what they want to do is, I guess, set up a network where you can go online and find out whether somebody is in your network. Of course, who's going online when it's an emergency, right? So I wanted to get your thoughts. Apparently, it was a pretty close vote to come out of the committee. Yeah.
You may want to speak on the House. We also have a pending one also in the Senate that's also basically the same bill. I think our position so far has been one of support, but it is a major issue. Along with actually Medicaid expansion, when we start talking about surprise billing, when a person goes outside of their network and all of a sudden they have these type of bills that come in. So it's an issue that we need to address as the state. There are some questions about it. But I think overall, I think we probably should go forward with it as a first step, as a start.
Yeah, well, this is big for the governor. So I know he really wants this. And it is shocking when you think you've paid your bill and then these bills come in from all of these different people, the anesthesiologist, different people that you didn't even consider.
Yeah, but you also have that with, I understand this is specifically about if you go out of network.
Right.
But if I'm in network and I go have a physical or I have some treatment, there's almost no time that I don't get a bill a month later from somebody that I didn't know,
right?
that I didn't see, because the insurance company didn't want to pay, what the provider was charging or whatever. So it's like a bigger issue, I think, than just if you're out of network, because you can be in network and still get billed a lot of money.
Yeah, and then we should say this is for private insurers. It's not for the employer insurers.
Right. And this bill's been in the works for about 6 years by Chairman Richard Smith, who's now the rules chairman. So he's got a lot of very, very important people behind it. Yeah. And I think everyone wants transparency, and we have to reduce healthcare costs. We just have to do that.
But it's like the ultimate difficult thing to do because you have such big moneyed interests involved in it, and nobody wants to give up, which is true in any industry, but in particularly big industries like this, nobody wants to give up a dime. So it's really got to be hard to try to negotiate.
And that's why it's taken 6 years.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
Well, right. We'll see how it goes this year, as we've got the bills on both houses. Let's change gears a little bit now and talk about another bill that was passed out of a House committee on Tuesday, HB 847. Police across Georgia would be empowered to arrest people for possession of small amounts of green leafy substances. It could be marijuana, it could be hemp, but they don't know. And the illegal marijuana, legal hemp, and the violators could face up to a year in jail, $1,000 fine for possession, the same penalty as with the misdemeanor marijuana. What are we thinking, Senator Jones?
I think we're thinking that's going to be a lawsuit waiting to happen, quite frankly. Mm-hmm. I think that's where we're heading. I would be very hesitant to do that. And so what happened was, of course, a lot of jurisdictions, when we determined that we couldn't tell the difference, a lot of jurisdictions said we're not going to prosecute basically misdemeanor marijuana because we don't have the test to do that. And so therefore, our jurisdiction in Augusta basically took the same tack. And I think it's a very dangerous road, quite frankly, to get on because, number one, we ought to be talking about marijuana reform anyway. And then secondly, to actually start talking about arresting persons, if it passes, that the persons are not actually arrested because they can be given a ticket and then just come back to court, but not actually be arrested to where they have to post bond. Give them a ticket to where they can come back to court. And then hopefully by then we have some type of test that can determine it. But if we start depriving persons of liberty, even on that initial part, that's going to be extremely problematic. And I just think that it's an area we really shouldn't be wading into.
Yeah, and what they're talking about is actually having anybody, like a hemp farmer, actually have paperwork with them the whole time to prove that
right.
this is
yeah,
what
you're arresting
this is.
Someone for carrying illegal substance.
Correct.
Which
yeah.
is like, probably
that's
unconstitutional.
Right.
So, no thoughts on
don't,
that.
Don't let it come out.
Stay clear. Way away
for that one.
Yeah.
I'm not
going to get that.
Yeah, I don't believe it.
The other thing that we're hearing a lot about down at the Capitol, and this is the hands-free driving law. Okay, so we've had it for what? 3 years now? We've had it. Mm-hmm. And pretty successful, although we're still having problems. The bill, HB 113, would increase the fines, like doubling them. So first offense, $50 would go to $100. Second offense, $200, and then $300 for a third offense. The fight is over, are we doing enough? Will the fines actually reduce things? I don't know.
And Donna, you and I met about a dozen years ago,
working
on Caleb's Law, which unfortunately
right.
a young man killed himself texting while driving. And we've gradually strengthened those laws, and we've saved hundreds of lives. I think 300 lives every year are saved by these laws. So I'm all for this. I know that the chairman doesn't like it, but I think we need every day, air driving to Atlanta, you see people texting and driving, even with the laws in place.
Yeah, I can't imagine. I don't drive highways to work because I live in town. But even in my neighborhood in beautiful downtown Oakhurst, mm-hmm. that's a hashtag.
hashtag
Oakhurst. Almost every day I see someone, cruising around with the, you know, phone to the ear. And, you know, frankly, the chairman, this is Alan Powell, I believe, right?
Yes.
So he and I were both around. We're old enough to have been around when they passed the bill saying you had to wear a seatbelt.
No.
And we had Speaker Murphy, who drove a truck, didn't want to wear a seatbelt. And he announced on the House floor during the debate, you know, I'm not going to wear a seatbelt.
That's right.
So he comes from that era. And, you know, that I think probably took a certain number of years for everyone to say, well, I'm going to wear my seatbelt. And I don't know what the fine is, but the fine's not that big. Yeah. So it may be a question of it's just going to take a long time to, and not maybe a long time, but it's going to take time for people to understand that you shouldn't be doing it.
Well, I think that some people will become more complacent about it. Like, you know, it's been a few years. Maybe I'll try it a little bit. Nobody's ever stopped me. I've never seen anybody stopped. And maybe they're at the point where the, you know, maybe just talking about it or trying to increase these fines might work.
If you look at research now, fines necessarily by themselves don't necessarily deter the conduct. But at the same time, we may want to increase it. I would be very curious about what that is, what fines are going to be increased to, because it is a dangerous endeavor. But we also have to realize that those fines can be very problematic for people to pay. And so we do want to look at that, too. So I'll just be curious about how we're escalating the fines. But it is very dangerous conduct. So if we have to look at it, certainly we should do that. Let's just be very careful about how we try to structure the fine.
And James, you talked about seatbelts. There's a seatbelt bill, too, for getting people to wear their seatbelts in the back seat, which is people are fighting against it. I don't know. Well, I think there's a whole generation of kids, at least, that grew up with having to do
that.
I think
we might have even done a poll or something on this, or seen a poll or reported on a poll that showed most people think that's the law anyways.
Most people think that's the law anyway. It actually came up in committee yesterday, and I was on that committee, and I actually we're still going to do some work on it. There's still some work to be done on it. One of the issues that I had with it was that it could be used to actually, when I asked the author of it, his explanation was it could be used to actually pull persons over. That becomes a little bit problematic for me as a former prosecutor.
Okay, talk about that a little bit. What are your issues with it then?
Well, because now we're not talking about necessarily children anymore. We're talking about an adult in the back seat that now I'm responsible for, and if they don't have their seatbelt on, that then gives calls to be able to pull me over as a driver. I just very concerned whenever we start talking about interfering with persons in that manner.
For that reason only, they could pull you over. That's what you're saying.
That's what the author, okay. That was his explanation. That was his feeling about it. So we need to look at that. For something that, because remember, the way the bill is structured, the way it reads is, it's not a moving violation and it's not a criminal offense. And so my question was, well, would that give them a police opportunity on that alone to pull someone over? And his answer was yes. I'm not even necessarily sure that's accurate. But if that's the case, then that becomes very problematic, because if it's not a criminal offense and it's not a moving violation, how then are we using that as a primary reason to pull someone over?
All right. So I just wanted to, I've got some of the information in front of me now. It would increase the fine from $15 to $75.
Yes.
For kids 8 to 17 who go unbuckled would rise from $25 to $125. Right. Those are significant increases in the fines.
Yes, and that also came up, too, about the fine structure. Once again, talking about that as far as the fines going up.
All right. So we'll see how that goes. But a lot of things dealing with what takes place in the cars. We're going to have to take a break now. And then I want to talk with our lawmakers here about your individual bills that you've sponsored. This is Political Rewind. We'll be back in just a moment. Welcome back to Political Rewind. I'm Donna Lowry with GPB Lawmakers in for Bill Nygut, and happy to have Representative Belton and Senator Jones and James Sulzer with me right now. And I'm going to throw something out to you, because we understand Ed Tarver is from your area,
yes,
and he has now formally announced that he is going to run for Senate for the Kelly Loeffler seat, and He's from your area. Any thoughts
from
on
Augusta,
this?
Yes, he's from Augusta.
He's
former state senator.
Former state.
That was in the seat that I hold now. I've known former Senator Tarver and former U.S. Attorney Tarver for many, many years. I was an intern with a federal judge, and he was a law clerk. So this is a long time with the sense I've known him. I think he's a great addition to the race. Obviously, you know, being from Augusta, we're supporting him and hopefully he can do well. I think his lane or path that he's looking at is by being former law enforcement in the U.S. Attorney's Office, by being a former Senate senator, by having those kind of two things merged together of experience and kind of being able to show that he can, quote unquote, work across the aisle and things of that nature. I think that's the path that he'll be kind of taking. And hopefully that's a path that the voters of Georgia will accept.
Well, that race gets more interesting every day.
Yes,
it does.
Yes, it does.
So let's talk about law enforcement a little bit while we're talking to you. You filed a bill removing the statute of limitations on rape,
yes,
aggravated sodomy, and aggravated sexual battery. You do not want any statute of limitations at all on this.
Correct. And it's not quite as expansive as persons may think, because we already do that in two areas. For instance, if you get the identity of a person from DNA, so you don't know who the person is, and you get it through DNA, you're able to, that has no statute of limitations. If you're under 16 and you're a victim of rape or aggravated sodomy, that also has no statute of limitations. So then the question becomes, so if a person is 16 in a day, now they don't have the same credibility, or they only have the 15 years. And I also want persons to understand this is not ex post facto. So it doesn't go back and get anybody back in time. It will start today, or when the bill is actually passed, that there will be no statute of limitations. But when you start talking about rape, aggravated sodomy, when you start talking about offenses like that, the trauma that it has, not only the victim, but the victim's family and things of that nature, is so great. Why are we putting this really arbitrary number? And one of the questions for me was, okay, do we take it from 15 to 20 to 25 years? We're just making up numbers. If we really believe the impact is that great, which it is, then we should have no statute of limitations to that and allow persons to be able to come forward when they can.
So, Senator Jones, so let me understand this. You're saying that previous crimes that have taken place would not be affected
that's
by
correct,
this at all.
Right.
That's
correct. That would be an ex post facto law. You cannot do that.
What's the statute of limitations on
15 years.
15 years.
Yes.
Okay. We're going to get back with you on
Absolutely.
Your bills, but I want to get over to you, Representative Belton. You have a bill that will offer college loan forgiveness for teachers who teach in the turnaround schools. And what are there, about 100, 110?
It's turnaround and also the distantly rural schools, remotely rural schools. The universe I have is about 232 schools in total. And it's hard to believe, but last year we had 3,112 teaching positions were not filled. That's almost 90,000 children not being served correctly. So I'm trying to fill those positions. And by offering a little bonus to do that, most states do this. 40 states have a provision like this. We're one of the few that don't.
Yeah, and so college loan forgiveness, you go into school. Do you know how long would they
I'm
have to teach
for five
in these
years.
Schools? 5 years.
That's right.
Which is when the average teacher, what is it?
22%.
22% of all teachers, a fourth of all teachers essentially leave the profession after
right.
5 years. So,
and the average Georgian who graduates from college has about $27,000 of debt. That's the average. So I'm offering, what I've tried to offer is $5,000 per year for 5 years would be $25,000.
Yeah. And I see you shaking your head, James. You think this might work?
Well, I mean, it's interesting. I think you also, correct me if I'm wrong, but don't you also have a bill, or we're discussing a bill that would allow veteran teachers to retire
return
and then
work.
Come back,
that's exactly
which
right.
I think is another, I think it's a discussion, an interesting discussion because particularly in rural areas, the discussion was, well, what, you know, we give these great teachers and they retire and they can't continue working, and so we're replacing somebody with 34 years or how many years with someone, if we can get somebody right out of school or whatever. Not that someone right out of school is not well prepared, but there's a big difference between the education you're probably getting from a 23-year-old or 24-year-old and someone who's been in the profession 34
years. I'm trying
years.
To go from both ends, James. That's a good observation. You know, the teacher pipeline is shrinking. It just is. The economy is good. Less and less people want to be teachers. But I'm also saying, hey, we got these great teachers. These, I call them super teachers. They've been around. And they can only return to work if the school board wants them.
Right.
So they can't just do that.
On their own.
Yeah, on their own. They got to be good teachers.
And what? They're 49 percenters. I mean, they
no, I'm trying. I'm saying they can come back full pay.
They want them full pay.
Yeah.
Not,
as long as the employer is going to pay the employer and the employee TRS portion. So it's essentially a free teacher for the TRS because they've already paid for that teacher.
But it's an amazing deal for the teacher because if the teacher's getting paid, I don't know, $60,000 a year, if they've worked 35 years, they're getting $42,000 pension, and they'll get the salary. So, I mean, if you, it's a great incentive to continue teaching. And I've years ago there was an audit done. I forgot how many, but it's a pretty substantial number of teachers, thousands of teachers who are 49%ers who do teach part time. So, you know, I don't remember if there was any kind of estimate of how many there would do it.
What we say is they have to stay out for 1 year. And therefore, the estimate goes down to zero. It costs $0.
Right. You know what? I talked to a lot of teachers who are 49%ers who would love to do it more, to teach more. They feel like they had to retire, but they would love to come back. So that's not your bill.
It's my bill.
Your bill. You have that one and loan forgiveness.
Yes,
okay. We'll be watching both of those.
Knocking it out on education.
So, let's get back to you, Senator Jones, a little bit. You also have a bill that would focus on trying to restore voting rights to people who have been convicted of crimes.
Right, convicted of nonviolent felons. So currently in Georgia, if you have a crime of moral turpitude, you're not able to vote if you're on probation or parole. This would not affect persons incarcerated. And so we don't define what moral turpitude is. So what the bill does is just list out the crimes that will qualify as moral turpitude. And it's similar to what Alabama has done, and it's also similar to what Mississippi has done. Both of them have passed these type of bills where we list out these are the crimes of moral turpitude. These are the crimes that would actually prevent you from voting. Alabama and Mississippi has passed similar legislation. Certainly if Alabama and Mississippi can do it, we can do that also.
How many voters are we talking about as a possibility?
It actually is only, and that's the key thing, it's not actually going to change an election when you really look at it. First of all, everyone's not going to vote. Everyone's not even going to register. But you're probably starting at a base of about 70-something thousand voters.
Yeah. What kind of reaction are you getting?
You know, normally a lot of persons are saying, well, why should a person be able to vote? Well, here's the situation. We want a person to be a good citizen. We want them to pay taxes. We want them to get a job. We want them to get a GED. Part of being a good citizen is actually being an exercised right to vote. That all goes together. Right now, in courts in Georgia, judges are telling all defendants, go get a job, pay child support. But if that defendant then raises his hand and says, Judge, I understand, I'm going to do all those things. You want me to be a good citizen, but can I vote? And the judge is going to say you can't, and that shouldn't be allowed.
Okay. Representative Belton, I want to quickly talk about another bill you have that I just find interesting.
Okay.
The children who are entertainers, they are in the TV industry here, they're in the movie industry here, and they have a problem when it comes to school sometimes for being marked absent.
Yeah, that's actually a Valencia Stovall's.
Okay.
I was the second sign on her.
Yeah.
Exactly right. But yeah, she has a lot of movie people down there because of the Tyler Perry situation. And so she's just trying to make it easier for those kids to get a good education.
I just think that's interesting.
I love Valencia Stovall. She's
I think I had you both on Lawmakers Together, right?
We did, exactly.
That's right. Yeah. I'm going to have you back on. Okay, so let's talk about something real quick if we can get it in. Those who support Georgia's immigration workforce oppose Representative Singleton has a bill that it would effectively ban sanctuary cities. Okay, so House Bill 915 would allow law enforcement to detain undocumented workers. And several local governments we know have declared that they are sanctuary cities. Atlanta, Clarkston, DeKalb County as a whole. Your thoughts on that bill?
I don't know how cities can say they're sanctuary cities. I mean, there's a federal government out there. We had a civil war over this sort of issue, you know, about whether or not states and cities could do their own laws, and we decided that they can't.
But
so,
there's dispute down here whether who won that.
Yeah. Yeah.
No, they're still deciding whether
it's
Yeah, some people don't know. So you just don't believe that it's.
I have not studied that bill a lot, but it seems outrageous that cities and states are saying we're going to ignore the federal laws. It's just outrageous.
So
it's always local to us, not. We
Senator
always say
Jones.
We don't defer to the local to we don't. You know, being a House bill, I've not had an opportunity to look at it, but I do think we should, on some levels, defer to our localities if they believe that that's what's in the best interest. But at the same time, of course, it does have broader ramifications. So I would like to look at it and see, because these are legitimate issues on both sides, quite frankly. So I'm not necessarily just saying, oh, you can just be a sanctuary, just do whatever you want. It is a legitimate state issue to talk about immigration. But I also say we always talk about local till we don't. And if these cities believe what's in their local best interest, we ought to take a look at that and not just necessarily dismiss it.
Yeah. Yeah, it does focus on the local issue, doesn't it,
right,
James?
Right, but you also, I mean, I've often said, covering the legislature for 30 years, people are for local control until they're not on issues. It was very similar. But on the other hand, it is a federal law. So the state can't just say, I mean, well, I think they've tried sometimes, but they're not legally allowed to say, you know, well, we're not going to follow federal law. So, I mean, that's kind of the debate on it. It's you're right. It's local control on this issue. But you're going against the federal government. The federal
government is not given access or authority for these sanctuary cities and states to exist. It's just outrageous.
All right. Well, we'll see what happens to that. Before I let you guys go, I thought we'd find out an estimate, a guess as to how long the legislative session's going to go. Now that we have the mid-year budget through, what are you thinking, James?
June. No, I'm just kidding. No, it'll be before the primary, I know that.
Oh, okay. You really think it'll be before March 24th?
No, before the primary. Not the presidential primary.
The presidential primary.
I would guess early April.
I've heard an ugly rumor it may be after the Masters.
It might be, and that's shocking.
That is shocking.
Yeah. What do you think?
I thought it was going to be around April the 3rd, but that would be very interesting if we go.
April 1st last year? It was April Fool's Day, and then the Masters is what, the 9th? You would know.
It's going to be the first week in April, so it would be about the 6th, I believe, is when it would come out.
Well, we got to go. That will do it for Political Rewind today. I'd like to thank our guests, James Seltzer, Senator Harold Jones, Representative Dave Belton, and Taifa Smith-Butler, who had to leave. And remember, if you missed any part of this show or you liked it so much you want to listen again, you can listen and go on a podcast. See ya.